You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This is the CRM Archaeology Podcast. It's the show where we pull back the veil of cultural resources management archaeology and discuss the issues that everyone is concerned about. Welcome to the podcast. Hello and welcome to the CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 158 for February 27th, 2018. I'm your host, Chris Webster. On today's show, we talk about getting your side hustle on with our new digital marketing affiliate and about raising kids while doing archaeology. So get the kids off to school and let's get to work because the CRM Archaeology Podcast starts right now. All right, welcome to the show, everyone. Joining me so far today is East Coast Bill in Maryland, although he can just be Bill since there's no other Bills on the show.
Hi there.
I know Bill White is coming in, but he's just not here on the recording yet, so we might have some other people pop in as we're going along here. And we have a couple different topics today, as I mentioned in the introduction. So the first one, though, is with a person named Seth Himes, and I'll introduce Seth in a second here. Well, I'm introducing him right now, but we'll bring him on in a second. I met Seth coming on 2 years ago now here in Reno and found out he's got this digital marketing course. And I actually have a friend here in town who's an archaeologist who took the course. You know, we've just been talking about it. And so then we decided that it's kind of a good fit with the Archaeology Podcast Network when we always talk about side hustles and having something else to do, whether it's in the off season full time or between jobs or in the evenings in addition to your job or something like that. And it sounds like something like this is somewhat of a good fit. So Seth, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Chris.
Nice. All right. So if you guys want to check this out while we're talking, I created the affiliate page for us that will link you to Seth's page. So that's arcpodnet.com/side hustle. Okay. So arcpodnet.com/side hustle. So Seth, first, how did you get into digital marketing?
Well, and pardon me, I've been at a conference all weekend, so my voice is kind of gone. I went to film school back in the day, which is, you know, pretty useless degree. And I was just like lost in my 20s as far as how to freaking make money. So it was about 8 years ago. I just stumbled into digital marketing because I went to a seminar and I saw that, you know, it's possible to use the internet for something more than just watching cute cat videos and porn. There's actually commerce and an ability to share a message, sell a product, communicate. So many things you can do with the internet. Blew my mind. So I started to teach myself about SEO, search engine optimization, paid search, running blogs, doing affiliate marketing, email marketing, all these things I'd never heard of. What was amazing is that I was able to learn these very, very valuable concepts online. Without any formal education. And before I knew it, you know, within about a year, I had been running my own course on filmmaking, because I said that's my passion. I was selling a course on filmmaking. I was making some good side money. Wasn't enough to live on, but it was pretty cool. But what I didn't realize is that I had built up a very valuable skill set, and I applied for an agency job, and I was hired to my disbelief. And they immediately handed me $100,000 in monthly ad spend to manage.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And my supervisor, who was the VP, actually like helped mentor me, and I became a PPC specialist, a paid search specialist, managing Google ads, because most people don't really realize that Google makes all their money from advertising. Mm-hmm. Those ads, when you do a search and you see all those ads that you probably don't click on, people do click on those ads, and that those clicks generate billions of dollars every year for Google. And companies, there's millions of companies that are running those ads, and they need people to manage those ads. You know, I found myself in this field where suddenly I went from like unemployed art school graduate with no valuable skills to suddenly being very in demand. Recruiters were after me. I was making very good money. And there are just so many opportunities, you know, having this skill set. So that's how I kind of got into it.
So what made you go from, okay, I just found this new lucrative career to, I want to teach other people how to do it?
Well, I never wanted a day job. And like, I know you've told me archaeology, you know, seems like it's a lot of people are, I don't know if the word is free spirits, but it's not a conventional job, right? You don't want to sit in an office for 8 hours a day, right?
Right.
I never like that. I want to be an entrepreneur. So what was funny is that I have so many job offers, and I actually, 1 year I was working at a in-house job making, I was up to six figures by my third year. Mm-hmm. And then I got poached by another company. And that's what happens all the time. Recruiters, there's such a desperate need for people with this skill set, both for jobs, like day jobs, and freelance work. Mm-hmm. It's just so, there's just so much demand and not enough people that know how to do it. So this guy who actually was a multimillionaire, he was about 35, he'd sold and he made all his money in inkjets. He wanted me to work for his company. And I jumped ship from one job to run another job. But then mm-hmm. after a month there, I was like, I can't keep working for other people. I need to work for myself. So I quit. I quit two very good jobs within like 2 months. Mm. And I always talk to my buddies in this field. We kind of laugh because I said, we feel like the prettiest girl at the dance because we're always getting hit up by recruiters. Companies always want to hire us. This is such a weird problem. No one else has. Nobody knows about this field. You don't hear about it on the news. If you go on the news, it's like, oh, the economy stinks. And or we added 200,000 new jobs, like people working at Starbucks or something.
Right.
So nobody knows about this field. And I said, I can't take 20 jobs, right? I can't multiply myself. So I have an earning limit, but I'll bet I can show people how to get these jobs. Hmm. And, you know, I've been working in the sort of entrepreneur community forever, and people are always selling to entrepreneurs, you know, build your own business. Sort of. I was like, and that's great because you can build your own business with these skill sets. And a lot of my students do. But I said, well, I'm going to target job seekers because there's so many. And a lot of these college kids come out. They haven't learned anything practical in school. I'm going to give them practical advice and I'll bet I can help them. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened. When I finished the course, I think, you know, I partnered with Matt at Engineered Truth, who has a big YouTube channel. And it just blew up. Like, the students I got were so motivated and so wonderfully just great people. They actually listened to what I said to do, applied it, and they started getting jobs. And it went from like having one or two testimonials to then like 10 to now dozens and hundreds of people who continue to get jobs in this field, or they say to get more in alignment with what I think your audience would be interested in, get clients. A lot mm-hmm. of my students, once they, some of them for the confidence, they want to work in an agency just to have a job. But then almost all of them eventually want to quit having a day job and freelance or get their own clients because it provides them with freedom to pursue what they want to do with their lives and also make money.
Sure, sure. Well, let's step it back just a little bit and go to the course without obviously, you know, giving away the punchlines here. What can people learn in your course? Like what types of things, if you go through the course, do people pick up and get skills in?
Well, my course is unique because I do teach digital marketing skills. I focus on Google Ads, SEO, which is search engine optimization, which is basically making alterations to websites so that they show up higher in the Google search results, which gets businesses more traffic, more customers, and more money, and social media marketing. So yeah. I teach these skills and I teach Google Ads, like I said, which is very hard to find good training on how to do a proper account structure for Google Ads. But what's funny is Google has tried to make their platform user-friendly, right? Mm-hmm. So they want to say, hey, you run your own hair salon, you can advertise on Google. It's super easy. But Google, they're geeks. Their idea of easy is not easy for the average person. So that's why most businesses need to hire somebody to actually manage their ads. And the types of adjustments that you need to make to these accounts are not that difficult. Mm-hmm. I tell people it's sophisticated, but it's not like learning coding. Mm-hmm. It's not like, because to me, coding, I don't want to learn coding. It's too complicated. It's going to take up too much of my brain space. But digital marketing is like, it's like just like, I think it's like having a passion or like really getting into like historical fiction or something. It's like you can nerd out on it and learn it and be an expert without completely, you know, spending, you know, 2 years of intensive study.
Right.
But the real difference with my course and why I'm so passionate is that like, that's only half the course. The other half of the course is how to actually get the damn job and how to get the client. Because, yeah. you know, we've talked about college and these degrees and they give you all this esoteric information. You come out, you're just like, what the hell do I do? Mm-hmm. How do I actually, like, you know, survive in the real world? So that's actually part of the course. It's not like you have to figure shit out afterwards. They teach you how to change your resume, change your LinkedIn, how to go on Upwork and find clients. And this is how my students as young as 19 are getting hired for these really good jobs. Mm-hmm. And leveling up, you know, whether a person wants to have an in-house job where they start out at 40,000 and then a year later, I got like one student that's now making 75,000.
Nice.
Or someone like Karen, one of my students up in Ohio, she's 21. She works, I think, 20 hours a week and makes about 52K a year.
Nice.
So she's doing part-time SEO. She's bilingual. So she does SEO for an insurance company that sells to English speaking and Spanish speaking customers. Hmm. So I have students doing all sorts of, and I'll tell you in a minute, I mean, I have students doing all sorts of crazy things, but just like, you know, if you can just get a couple of freelance clients, it's not like a crazy thing where you see an online business where it's like, you have to spend, a hundred hours a week and like, you know, blood, sweat, and tears to build this thing. It's like, no, man, what if you could get one client paying you $500 a month to do their Facebook ads or their Google ads or their SEO? Like, that make a huge difference to most people, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's what I wanted to get into next was, you know, because for our audience, I mean, archaeology is really, nobody gets into this through the money. You know, they get into it because they're passionate about the subject and they struggle to stay in it despite the money, despite the fact that you don't pay very much and the schedule. So we are really promoting this as a side hustle, as something you can do, as I mentioned in the introduction, in kind of the, I guess, in the off season. You know, I know people who do around here in the Reno area and anywhere where it's snowy, they're like ski instructors in the off season because you can't do archaeology in the winter. Or they're tax accountants. I know one guy that did taxes from like January to April, and that was his side hustle. You know, his primary gig was archaeology. So what is the reality there for somebody who's working in this field? They're traveling around, you know, they're always in a different place. They're working out of hotels, things like that. What's the reality for them getting out of this course and getting a couple clients and being able to maintain those while they're doing other things? What's the workload on something like that? And is the payoff there for just a couple of clients?
Absolutely. Like I said, I mean, you know, whether you're doing, you know, like someone like Karen, she just did a couple of small jobs for this one client and now they liked her so much, they wanted to take her on full time to do 20 hours a week. And now she has basically a full-time salary that's more than anyone her age that she knows. You know, working 20, you know, part-time essentially. But mm-hmm. I have other students who have just gone out and, you know, they got two or three clients and they're getting paid anywhere, you know, they might get paid on the low end, you know, $300 or $400 a month to on the high end, you know, $1,000 or $1,500 a month. Because remember, they're getting, this isn't pie in the sky stuff. They're getting paid this because they're making money for other companies. You know, mm-hmm. like mm-hmm. I've paid $1,000 a month to a Facebook ad specialist when I didn't want to manage my Facebook ads because the Facebook ads bring business to me. But I have plenty of my students who do go on to do the freelance thing. And like I said, a lot of them, they want to work in an agency first. It gives them the confidence of a day job mm-hmm. and they spring off from there. But almost all of them, once they've worked at an agency for a little bit, they start getting their own clients. And it's very different. Selling this service is very different than trying to be like a personal trainer or something because you don't have to sell it. You just have to talk to people. Everybody needs this service. That's what's so mind-blowing is like every business, whether you know someone who's a lawyer or a tax accountant or runs a daycare center or somebody who runs a restaurant, everybody needs to advertise on the internet.
Yeah.
It's not an option anymore, especially for local businesses. What are they? They're not advertising on radio or TV. That's too much money. But you can make a real difference for local businesses with these digital marketing skills. You can go out locally. I have some people I say, go up to a business, you know? But a lot of people find people within their existing social circles. There's sites like Upwork, Upwork.com, which is kind of a monopoly on this. It's a freelance marketplace. And mm-hmm. anytime you log in there, you're going to see about 10,000 jobs in SEO, in PPC. There's people they're just constantly need this work. So it's very realistic to be able to do this. I'm kind of an evangelist for it because I'm just like, this is so much easier to do than what you just described, than being a ski instructor, than waiting. I've waited tables. I've done all that stuff. I've delivered pizzas. I would much rather, you know, be sitting at my computer managing an account. It's definitely mental work, you know?
Sure.
It's analytical, but it's a bandwidth of analytical, like where I say, like, if you can do archaeology, if you're an archaeologist, you can do this because you have, that means you're intelligent.
Right.
You can analyze information. You can handle this. I'm a film school graduate. So I'm not like, I didn't major in the sciences, but I have just like general intelligence and analytical ability.
Yeah.
So I think it'd be great. It sounds to me like when you and I became friends, you know, and I'm a film guy, it sounds like there's a lot of parallels between archaeology and film because film people are the same way. A lot of them, the crew guys, they don't get into it for the money. They just love doing it, but it's also brutal hours. You never know when you're going to work and they have to oftentimes take second jobs. So that's why I wanted to share it with, you know, your audience.
Yeah. Well, and that's great. To be honest, you know, if I wasn't doing 700 things right now, I've considered actually just taking your course just for my own purposes so I could get my own SEO increased and, you know, do my own stuff. But on the other hand, I mean, you're right though, because every business needs this. And I've got a, you know, podcasting thing that I do here in Reno, and I'm working with somebody at the Reno Collective. We're trading services, actually. That's how I'm getting it paid for. But she's going to start doing some of that stuff for me because you need to hire somebody who knows what they're doing to do this stuff and to get your message out there. So I think everybody go check out arcpodnet.com/side hustle. I can't remember what the relationship is, but it's an affiliate link. That's what you're clicking on that takes you to Seth's site. And if you purchase his course through there, then the APN gets a little bit of kickback. So you help yourself out, you help the APN out, and it's good all around. East Coast Bill, you got a comment?
I think this is like, you know, a very opportune time. I mean, right now we're in sort of the middle of winter, and a lot of people listening to us right now are not doing archaeology at the moment. If those fortunate enough to be writing are doing that, but for a lot of techs, this is the dry season. So it may in some ways feel like it's a little late in the process to start looking for stuff, but you know, you got to be prepared for next season. And I know like for us last year, for some reason, like the summertime became some drought periods. Hmm. So you never know when those dry periods are going to come up in your work schedule. So finding the thing to fill in those gaps. And from the sounds of this, it sounds like it's something that you don't necessarily need to physically be someplace. Cause that's always a problem with our stuff because we're always sort of on the move. We'll spend months away from home and things like that. So if as long as it's something tied to the internet, this definitely does sound like something that people could look at. And I do like the way we're framing this as a side hustle. It's not going to get you out of archaeology, even though I'm sure some of the people who take the course can get out.
Sure.
But I think for most people who might be interested, they're just looking to sort of supplement those incomes in those months when there is no income coming in. So it's nice to hear.
I think kind of the way I look at it too, Bill, is you get these other skills while you have the time. Like industry imposed time, which is time between jobs and winter time, like you said, you know, the dry spells in just natural dry spells in work. And if you have those time periods, well, use those time periods to just learn something new. I'm constantly telling people that. And if you can, you know, spend a little bit of money, this course is not even that expensive, but spend a little money and take the course and learn something new, even if maybe you don't even use it right away. But when your knees go out, you know, you can then have something to fall back on.
My knees are already out at this point, but I'm still pulling it out there. But it's not, I do need to have that backup plan. And everyone needs that backup plan, especially in a field that's so reliant upon, you know, your physical body. Your body is going to, spoil alert for those in their 20s. By the time you're in your 40s, your body is going to fail you.
Yes.
especially if you work CRM that entire time period. So having backup plans is a very, very important thing to have. And new skills are always good.
Yeah. I will just jump into just to speak to your audience because I was thinking, you know, when they click the link, you're going to be taken to an offer for the free introductory course because I provide a lot more in-depth information to people. I don't just say, hey, buy this thing.
Right.
Because there's a lot to be educated on about this field. One thing you'll see on the page, and it's funny because I've been meaning to make an additional page for freelance focused people, is that it does talk about jobs specifically. You'll also get emails from me and you can email me any questions you have. Because if you look at the actual page for the course, I do talk about the freelance opportunities. It's just like there's many different options you have when you have these skills. And I kind of gear the course right now is geared a little bit towards those people that want a job. But as I said, I've had just as many people who want to start their own business or have the freedom of freelancing. Mm-hmm. So if you see the word career or like salary in there, don't, you know, be turned off by that. There's ample opportunity for freelancing in this field. And like, I sure. like what you said about skills. I always tell people it's like Grand Theft Auto, you know, yeah. you got to go out on those gigs, you know, do a hit, you rob a bank, whatever. But instead of that, you're learning an actual valuable legal skill.
Nice.
You know, it's something you have in your back pocket. And you can always, it's just the feeling I like to say is that ever since I got this skill set, you know, I have other skills. Like I have a background in massage therapy. I've waited tables. I know how to shoot video. I've been a videographer. You know, I have all these random skills, but this is the one skill where I'm like, I feel so secure because mm-hmm. I know I can get a job even for 3 months. If I want to just work at a place for 3 or 4 months or do a contract or even just take a salary job for 6 months and then quit, I can do that. The turnover rate in this field, by the way, is very high, but it's not because people are getting fired and like, you know, there's like job attrition. It's because people change jobs so much. It's because they start working at one agency and then the other agency is like, we'll pay you more money to work over here. So I say it's like being a free agent. It's like, mm-hmm. I can work for 3 months over here if I want to have an in-house job for a while, and then I can freelance, and then I might have a client or two. I've had a client pay me, you know, pay me $800 a month. I've had a client pay me $3,000 a month because I'm doing much more work, but I'm always doing it from my computer. Like Bill said, you know, the freedom that the internet provides is like the best thing ever.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't like it, the idea that you have to be tied down. And I'll say this too, again, I'm not pushing jobs, but a lot of these jobs, it's really funny. I've had students also get remote jobs. Like mm-hmm. they have like, they have to work maybe 6 hours a day, but it's from home. Or if it's a agency job, they usually offer some type of remote option because these agencies are run by young people and they're like, yeah, like you're doing everything on your computer. You don't have to come in every day.
Yeah.
It's just having those options that's so exciting. You know, it's like most of us don't feel like we have options. Like we have to do this, we have to do that. Where it's like when you're like, well, I could do this. I could get a client. It's really liberating. That's all.
Well, I'll close this out by saying, you know, building on the options concept, because I like that too. And, you know, my thinking is if you can do something that allows you the freedom to work from anywhere, which is kind of a reason why people like archaeology too, like you can pick up jobs all over the country and you get to pick and choose where you work once you get skilled enough and you can actually pick and choose. But if you had something like this going and maybe you focused on it for a season, you know, backed away from archaeology, focused on it for a season, and then started making decent money with it on the side, then you can pick and choose the projects you want to work on for archaeology, you know, because a lot of times we get, you know, every fourth or fifth project might be just this dream project that's really awesome. And the rest is just BS that beats you down and you don't want to do it. Well, don't take the BS beat down jobs and just take the good ones because you've got this going on the side. So, and speaking of doing things on the side, it allows you to do a lot of other things. And Seth, why don't you take the last 30 seconds here and plug your movie?
Oh, okay. So that was the amazing thing is because I was doing, you know, all this digital stuff and I had all this free time and flexibility, I was able actually to produce a movie, which has been my lifelong dream in film. So I made a mm-hmm. comedy. It's about a group of friends who accidentally kill a bad guy and they screw up getting rid of the body. So they have to pretend that he's alive while they're being chased through downtown LA.
That's right.
And it's called Wally Got Wasted. And it's available now to rent on Amazon. We pitch it kind of as you might have already thought of this, Weekend at Bernie's meets The Hangover, but it's a completely mm-hmm. new story. And yeah, we've been getting great feedback. But so it's on Amazon to rent or purchase. Wally Got Wasted is the title. And it's funny.
It really is. Yeah, it's good. It's funny. I like it. The drone work in there is amazing. I don't know who you had to do that, but it was phenomenal. But no, I'm just kidding.
Chris did the drone.
No,
it really does look amazing.
Great.
With the color correction is amazing. It really looks. We shot it on a really low budget, but it looks like a studio movie. It's, you know, we're
looks
very
great.
Excited about it.
Yeah. Yeah. So, all right, we'll check that out. We'll link to everything we've talked about in the show notes here. So check those out at arcpodnet.com/CRM arcpodcast/158. And thanks, Seth, for coming on the show.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Well, we're going to switch gears right now. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to bring on a different guest and talk about children, which is, you know, if you got a side hustle and you got to stay home sometimes, maybe this would help out. So we'll be back right in a second. Hey everybody, Chris Webster here, back for just a quick second, reminding you to go to arcpodnet.com/side hustle to check out Seth's course today. We have some other affiliate links at arcpodnet.com/affiliates. But if you want to go straight to this, it's just /side hustle. So check it out, get going, and have something to do during your time off when you're between jobs or when you want to just have something else to do over the winter time. So again, arcpodnet.com/side hustle. Now back to the show.
Hello, this is Bill White. We're back with episode 158 of the CRM Archaeology Podcast. I was a little bit late, and so was Doug Rocks McQueen. He's joining us as well from Scotland.
Hey, everyone.
All right, so I wanted to bring this topic up because of a conversation that I had on Facebook. I guess the backstory is I have some students who have to bring their kids to class because there's yet another week-long holiday so the teachers can get reprogrammed by the district and parents can use the rest of their vacation time before we actually earn it. So I had some students that brought their kids to class, and that's no problem in my class, but I started to think, what would a parent do if they wanted to do archaeology and they had young kids and they couldn't go out and do the field work? And this is something that I, you know, have brought up before. In my case, you know, my wife takes care of the kids when I go out and dig holes in the middle of nowhere. So that's, you know, that's something that I don't necessarily have to worry about anymore. But I started to think, what would happen, you know, if you were a student and you had to handle kids? So I posed that on the North American Archaeology Field Techs Facebook group. And the results were essentially everyone just universally said, don't have kids if you have to go in field work or have a spouse or family take care of your kid. So it seems like there is essentially no option for your kid to come with you on field work or to go with you to field school. And the few people who did respond that said that they were able to bring their kids in the field were supervisors. So of course they can, because they're the ones who's in charge of the project. So I was asking other folks that I know that are archaeologists, and that brought me around to my good friend, Carrie Blake, who's been an archaeologist for a long time. We've known each other for a long time, and she's also a mom, and she's had her kids while she had to do field work too. So who better to talk about this than someone who's actually done it? Carrie, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Bill.
So I guess if you can tell us a little bit about your career and how you got into archaeology and had a family and how you've been able to make it work for so long.
Work. Yeah, that's an idea. Okay, so I started out as a field tech in 1999 after finishing my bachelor's degree. I did that and worked my way into a crew chief position until like 2003. Then I decided I needed to get more education because I wasn't going anywhere in my career. And so I went to graduate school in Washington. I'm at Washington State, where I met you. And while I was in graduate school, I got married. God help me. Then eventually that, of course, led to children. At some point, like in 2007, I had my first child and then went back to work doing cultural resource management in January of 2007. So yeah, I had my first kid in 2006, then went back to work in 2007 and did... luckily it was an in-town field project that I was on. And so I was able to work out a schedule where I had childcare Monday through Thursday. And then either my husband or myself would be home on Friday. So I was working what's called a 980 schedule. And I was also a field director. So I was kind of in charge. I was one of the three, four people that were in charge of the excavation project because it was extensive and required like something. How many people did we have on JCC? It was like, I don't know.
I was brought in late. I just looked at the artifacts after you dug them up.
That's right. It was like 30 or 40 people working on the excavation at one time. And then I had decent childcare. So I had my mother-in-law and my father-in-law and my own mother volunteered to watch my daughter. Or what? My mom didn't volunteer. The other two did. My mom got paid to watch my daughter for part of the week, part of each week. And then, it was just, it's chaos to have a kid while you're in the field because you've always got to juggle those things. And if you don't have a spouse that can take care of some of the childcare issues, like, I don't know how the hell you would do it.
Yeah.
It's just, I agree with everyone that says don't have kids if you're doing field work.
Yeah. And that's what that is so interesting because no one ever told me that. But as a woman, do you think that's directed towards women?
Yeah, absolutely. Because we have traditionally probably the last decade or so have been the bearers of the brunt of the childcare issue. You know, we're expected as our role as women, mothers, and wives to bear the majority of the childcare responsibilities. I mean, I was the one that had to do all the arranging for childcare, even though my husband's pretty like modern in the sense that he does a lot of the childcare. I still was the one that had to make all the arrangements. I was the one that called daycares. I was the one that called friends, family to see if they could help out.
Yeah, sure. That makes sense. That's kind of how it is at my house too.
Yeah. So
my wife is the one who keeps the kids alive. I'm just there. I do what I can, but yeah, I'm not equipped. Yeah.
I'm the one that does the grocery shopping list. I'm the one that makes the dinner menu for the week so that we have food and we're not spending excessive amounts of money on food. And so, yeah, it's a complicated process to have children and be a field archaeologist. When I got pregnant, like with my second child, while I was still doing CRM, there was some displeasure from the upper management because they were like, oh, well, I guess you can't do field work now, huh? Like somehow like growing another human being made it impossible for you to use a fucking shovel.
Well, I guess that, you know, I don't know, that brings us into a whole different line of questioning, but Bill, you've got a question.
Yeah. And actually sort of along the same line, it was about the idea of sort of pregnancy in the field. And that's, you know, I've not been pregnant, but I've seen and have had colleagues who've been pregnant in the field. And yes, there's a very tangible patriarchy that locks in when that happens. Some folks have been cool, but I've seen folks where, you know, as soon as someone's found to be pregnant, and this can be early in the process, they are trying to get them out, not schedule them for field work anymore, even though I've also known women who have been, most recently, I had a woman who was basically a week away from being induced who had come out to volunteer screening for us because she wanted to get something done before she was going to be laid up for the next 6 weeks.
Not to mention physical activity can like trigger labor. So
yeah,
there may have been some other incentives going on there.
You do see it in the workplace, this sort of tacit, you know, for lack of a better term, discrimination occurring against pregnant women in the field. It sort of harkens back, I think, to sort of this macho nature that CRM has as a field science, mm-hmm. that working in the field is somehow some sort of macho endeavor. And unless you're at peak physical whatever their ideal they're thinking of, it's incapable of it, even not realizing that actually being a pregnant woman is the most badass physical thing you can do in your life.
Yeah, it's not easy.
So in CRM, I mean, I know there's folks who worked in museums and do artifact analysis or maybe have an MBA or whatever, and they're, you know, in management. But seriously, if you're not in the field, that's the trial by fire for someone who's coming into the field. So if you're young and you have, a child, or if they're starting to prevent you from going out into the field on projects because you got pregnant, or even if they perceive that you could get pregnant too, which is another unspoken, no one ever says that, you know, managers don't make those decisions based on the fact that someone could become pregnant. But anyway, you miss field opportunities, right? So that obviously affects someone's career. So Carrie, what do you think about that? Do you think that, you know, having your kids and everything and them not letting you go in the field can affect your career?
Absolutely, because you don't, A, get the chance to advance your skills, And B, you don't get to show your capabilities. You're not going to get bumped up to crew chief if you can't show that you can handle the intricacies of an excavation or a large survey project. You're not going to be able to advance in your career if you're not out there showing the upper management that you're capable. If you're stuck constantly declining field projects because you've got a sick kid or your kid's got another goddamn snow day or your kid's got, you know, another vacation from school or whatever, like, you're not going to be able to advance in your career. And that's even when you don't even consider the gender politics of cultural resource management. Even without gender politics, if you're not going to be out in the field because you've got childcare responsibilities, you're not going to advance, just straight up.
Yeah, that's too bad. And it's interesting that you'd say that, because one of the things that I hear most frequently is that, you know, half of the archaeologists, or more than half of all the archaeologists, are women. But, you know, in my experience, usually the people who are owning and running the companies are not women. So,
nor are the people supervising field projects frequently.
Sure.
Yeah. It's not very often that you have a woman in charge of a field project, period. I mean, I've had female office directors, I've had female vice presidents of companies, but very rarely is it the woman who's in charge, the project director, or the field director for the projects that are actively being worked on in the field.
So I guess, is that gender politics, or is that just the fact that, you know, maybe it's a mother?
I don't know. It could be, it depends on the situation. It depends on the company. Like, you know, the experience that I've had where I've worked, for the most part, because we worked together for so many years, in that company, it was definitely gender politics.
Yeah, I definitely would agree. It's a company that I never name yet. Many times on the show, it comes up, you know, just many of the things that happened there too.
It's absolutely gender politics there. But in other places, I mean, maybe it's just that, you know, the women that were about to be supervisors, or the women that had worked their way into those positions, did get pregnant, did have babies. And so, like, yeah, they're out of circulation for those types of jobs.
What do you guys mean by gender politics?
I mean the preferential promotion of men over competent women.
Ah, okay.
That's what I mean. It's specifically the preferential treatment of that machismo in archaeology, in cultural resource management.
Yeah, and the company that we worked for too, there was a very clear differentiation. I mean, I don't know if it's actually in fact discrimination, but there was some pretty clear stuff that was happening on all sides, that it just, you know, it was all, this deck was always stacked so that individuals who were really skilled that were women just magically didn't end up running projects.
There was always an excuse found to hand high profile projects to male employees over more qualified or equally qualified women. Always. I worked for that company for 13 years.
It's more of like there's also this other more subtle thing that occurs with CRM specifically. And it's this idea that you need, as an employee in CRM, you have to be on call to do whatever the company wants with no notice whatsoever. So you can go weeks without getting a project, but if you get a call the night before, you're kind of expected to be out there in the field the next day.
Yes.
And that is going to adversely, you know, disproportionately affect those who have children, who have spouses, who have partners, who have other commitments in their, who have pets, who have other commitments in their life, that they cannot be sort of on call 24/7 for the CRM firm to whisk them around the country whenever they wish. It's the whole archaeology as gig economy, but you're still tied in as an employee. So you don't have the freedom of jumping from company to company, but you still have to be as flexible as a freelancer.
Yeah, that's huge.
That is huge. Okay, we're going to cut this segment a few minutes short. We'll continue the same line of discussion in segment 3.
Hey, podcast fans and digital archaeologists. Have you heard about WildNote?
It's a data collection app that works online or offline on your smartphone or tablet, iOS or Android. It allows you to collect field data easily, manage data efficiently, and generate data reports and site records effortlessly. We have a growing list of state site forms built in for your use and some generic forms that will work anywhere. Check out the shovel testing and photograph forms. You can get a free all-access 30-day trial today by going to wildnoteapp.com. That's wildnoteapp.com for your free 30-day trial. The Archaeology Podcast Network has partnered with TeePublic to bring you some awesome gear that looks good, promotes archaeology, and puts a few pennies in our pockets so you can get free podcasts. Check out our designs at arcpodnet.com/shop. That's arcpodnet.com/shop.
Okay, welcome back to segment three of the CRM Archaeology Podcast. We were just talking about how gender affects folks in the field, specifically women who are mothers in the field, but also we got into a great line of discussion about how CRM companies expect us to be ready at the drop of a hat and be ready for any project. And, you know, if you've got a family, that's something that it's more difficult to happen. But we got a question, Chris.
Yeah. So I am about to be 44-year-old white male with a graduate degree in this field, and I have no kids. So I really don't have a dog in this fight. However, I'm wondering, with the last segment, Carrie and even Bill, even both Bills, you know, we talked about a lot of problems with the field and how all this is managed, gender politics, children, all that stuff. Carrie, what would be your ideal situation? Like, what if we could fix everything tomorrow with the wave of a magic wand, what would be like the ideal situation for everything? Everybody wants to have kids, do stuff. I mean, obviously, job equality is a big one. But, you know, what would you see as your big things you'd want to see changed?
Well, it's not so much in the industry. The industry can be incredibly flexible for moms if you have the backbone to ask. Like, I remember after I had my second kid, I went back to work when she was like 6 weeks old. And then I had a field project start that was an hour and a half from my house, which is like the cutoff from about where they'll say, no, you're not commuting daily. You're going to stay overnight at that location. Mm-hmm. So it was like an hour and a half, 2 hours away. And so that started when she was about 2.5, 3 months old. So I was driving 3 hours a day round trip every single day to go do that, to run that field project and still be home for my nursing infant.
Right.
So they were totally accommodating to the fact that I was a breastfeeding mother and needed to pump in the truck. I had a power inverter in the supplied in the truck and a cooler and all of that. And I mean, I ran this project for 6 months, I think it was.
Yeah.
All total. It strung out for a while. But yeah, they completely accommodated the fact that I was driving the company vehicle every single day back and forth. So they had added mileage on the vehicle. Right. Added fuel costs, all of that. So the companies can be very flexible. I think it's the ideal situation would involve a multi-prong approach. Part of it is in American culture, like be some more supportive of moms, have more childcare availability, much more childcare availability. You know, there's more demand than there is space in childcare facilities. You know, there's good relationships. Don't have kids without a good relationship. Be with somebody who's going to help, like take care of your damn children, you know, be in a good relationship or at least try, have a support network if you're going to have children. I mean, those are all cultural things.
You know, I'm actually kind of curious about pumping in the field because a little bit of a backstory here. So when I was in the Navy, you know, we took breaks when we were on the, So we were at our base that was not the ship. The smokers in the group, I was never a smoker, but the people that did smoke, like they had to go a long ways away to go have a cigarette. And they were pretty much allowed to go do that anytime they wanted. And it was, you know, like a 20-minute walk round trip. So 10 minutes out, 10 minutes back, plus smoking the cigarette over there to do that. And the rest of us got like, you know, a 10-minute break. So it was seen as, Jesus, I'm going to take up smoking so I can get more breaks. I know we were just spent a long time back in North Carolina. My sister-in-law had a baby and she's breast pumping. And when she doesn't get to do it on the cycle that obviously she's making milk and it has to come out, it gets painful and she has to do it, you know, and you got to do it. So you got to do it pretty frequently. Did you get any pushback on that from people in the field? Like, man, she's taking a lot of breaks, you know, like sitting over in a truck pumping while we're working.
Well, it was actually kind of funny because what the project was, it was to go out and relocate a bunch of sites that had been recorded in the first two thirds of the 20th century. You know, so it was like 1940 sure. through 1978 or something. And so we had a bunch of these really old like site records. And so when it was time to pump, I had this older gentleman and this younger guy working for me on my crew. It was just me and these two guys. And the older guy had had kids and the younger one was like totally freaked out because he was like 23. And it was really actually very amusing for me because I'd be like, all right, guys, it's that time. Like, here's like here three site forms in this general area. Like, you head out in that general direction and don't come back for 30 minutes. Like, because there was a really low success rate on finding these sites because it was in Southern Arizona and it's very flat and it's got these like big ranges on the edges of everything, right? But the directions to find a site that was located in 1965 were just crap. It's just, it wasn't very useful. And you'd have these like photocopied topo maps and and it's like a dot on this like 1 to 100,000 scale map. And it's just like, okay. Yeah. And there's like, oh, there's this creek here and, you know, all these features on the landscape that weren't really there anymore. And like, you like sight in on this particular tree at this particular junction with the road and this rill. And so the guy, the younger guy, would like look at me like kind of like a deer in the headlights sort of thing and like not like make eye contact and then like kind of scurry off. And the older guy would be like, all right, see you in a bit. Like, and they didn't really have a problem with it for the most part. They were pretty chill with it and it was all right. It was just really hot because it was.
Oh, I can only imagine. You know,
it was like October in Arizona and it's really warm. In October. And
sanitation with all that equipment too is probably a huge deal out there as well.
Yeah. So a lot of extra water was purchased. A lot of extra supplies are handy, you know? Yeah. Yeah. All right.
I can see this as another reminder for those who maybe listen to us as sort of voyeurs into field work and maybe work in offices and don't actually work in the field. These are the kind of conditions we have to deal with, whether it's no bathrooms available, having to pump in the field. Yeah, any of these sort of the common accommodations you have working in an office environment don't exist in the field.
Warm water.
Warm water, shelter sometimes.
Yeah, and also those who don't know, we're talking about pumping breast milk for the baby.
Yeah. It's not like it's a keg or something in the back.
Yeah, not dewatering an excavation unit. We're not pumping the water out.
No.
Yeah, this is for a baby to survive. Because
that's kind of a pain too.
Your spouse, who is a man, is at home taking care of a child that does not have the ability to feed the baby. Or the preschool doesn't have a way to feed the baby. So you've got to pump the milk so that the baby can have milk during the day while the mother's out working.
Yeah. And if I wasn't hydrated enough, because, you know, supply is contingent upon like how much water you're consuming as well as food. Like if I didn't have enough water because I was busy or whatever, or it was a particularly hot day and I just didn't drink enough water, I didn't have a very high supply. So you'd have to supplement with formula or, you know, for the childcare.
Yeah, because also the other thing is the baby eats even more as it gets larger, right? So like months and, you know, 9 months in, a year in or whatever, the child's eating way more than when you first started. But you may be out in the desert, right? And so if the baby's born in the fall, then there's plenty. But then when it's summertime and the child's 9 months old and it needs to eat even more than ever before, that's when you're like the most dehydrated. Oh my gosh, Carrie, I cannot believe this. It's already difficult anyway, it's already difficult for a working mom anyway, when she has an office or her house or whatever. So out in the field, I can only imagine.
Yeah. And actually I had better privacy when I was out in the field because the guys were super respectful of the fact that they just didn't need to see that. I mean, I don't know if it was respect or just horror. I'm not sure.
I don't know if it's horror either. I don't know.
I don't know what it was, but they were always really, really great. Whereas like there were times when I was in the office and I'd have a sign on my door that said, do not disturb. And I had a couple of male supervisors just like walk in, like start opening my door.
What? Anyway, come on.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Our mutual favorite
who.
Well, he probably got scarred one time and then started to knock or learned how to read real fast.
right. Our mutual favorite incompetent supervisor. Yeah.
Just makes me very glad that I didn't start archaeology until my son was already 10. I didn't have to go through the early periods.
Oh, yeah. So that brings us to a whole new phase, Carrie, because your daughter is now, what?
12.
Yeah. And you have a younger daughter that's 7. Yeah, so now is it easier? Is it different? Is it better? What's now that you go out?
Now I'm the boss and I don't have to go out the field as much. Yeah.
Okay.
Now I'm in charge of an environmental group and I don't have to go out nearly as often. But it's actually really easy now because my husband, he has an office job, and so the kids go to school. If I'm in the field, they just go to school and he works from the house or whatever needs to be done. And then he's home and they get home from school. And the 12-year-old can kind of chill by herself for like 45 minutes if needed without a parent here. And my kids are really responsible, so they're really good kids.
I guess the encouraging thing is if you can survive the early years, you know, as the child gets older, it's different. It's just better. And also the parents' careers change. So you can imagine the 10 years of you guys both working in the same industry. By that time, you're, you know, much higher up. You have more authority. To work from home is actually an option now, and they don't harass you about it. So I guess it totally changes as the child gets older.
It also helps if you do get those advanced degrees. If you're still working as a field tech and you've got a 10-year-old, you're still going to have the same shitstorm you had when they're a baby because you're still on call. You're still going to have to take that job. Like that field project that comes up, like, oh, I've got to go out to the Warm Springs Reservation for the next 8 days. Well, okay. And then you scramble. You're still going to have to do it because, you know, your 10-year-old can't take care of herself for 8 days straight.
Sure.
By herself, you know, or himself, you know, it's not going to happen. So if you're still teching and you're still a single parent, you're still going to have the same issues come up and haunt you as you would if you had a baby or a toddler. Because you still have that childcare element and you still, if you have to be gone, you have to be gone. And what is your kid going to do? You can't pull them out of school for 8 days while you go and like hike around in the middle of nowhere in Central Oregon. You know, you just can't do that.
Bill.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that happens as you're dealing with an older child on this this could happen at any age. But dramatic life events like divorce, all of a sudden now you've lost that sort of partner and you're now doing sort of separate child cares. And that's very disruptive, to put it mildly on there. But more importantly is if you're still doing the intense field life at that time, you're going to miss out on things. You're going to miss, you know, soccer games and school recitals and things like that. And while it's a baby and babies have immediate physical needs. As the child gets older, they have more emotional needs. They're going to remember you didn't show up to the spring concert because you were out in the woods someplace and things like that. So those are the other kinds of like sort of more mental weights that go onto a parent who work in a field that's going to have them away from home a lot.
The parental guilt.
Yeah. It's real. It's there. And previewing for those, because actually, let me shout it out today. So today, as we're recording this, is my son's 21st birthday. Happy birthday, Liam.
Right on.
And it changes. It doesn't get easier. It just changes. It's a joy. I don't regret any day of it in case he does listen to this. Probably won't. But it changes. It's more of the mental strain that occurs afterwards. It's the phone calls late at night. It's the request for money when it's already hard enough to make money in this field. You know, I want to go to college. What do you want to be? Anything but an archaeologist.
I'm always telling my kids they can't be archaeologists.
I don't know. I'd like to see one of my kids do it, but they're not interested.
He's not interested. I would actually be happy if he was. He wants to be a music producer right now. So we'll see how that goes.
All right.
My oldest wants to engineer prosthetics that link into the human nervous system.
Okay. I like that one too.
That's nice too.
My son wants to play video games for a living. I don't like that one. But I can imagine how my parents felt when I said, I'm going to be an archaeologist. And I was, you know, 8 years old. Okay, you can do that, son. And then when I'm 18, they're kind of like, what? I don't know.
Mine didn't even know what it was. Mine didn't even know what it was.
Is that business? Saying. If it's not business, then no.
Yeah.
All right, Carrie, I guess moving on. What do you have anything you'd like to say to people who are out there that have kids that are trying to do CRM? And I mean, I know what it's like to have kids, but I was a dad, so it's not the same as being a mom. I guess any special messages to folks out there listening that have kids and they're trying to figure it out?
Well, don't feel guilty. Like, it's your job. Your job is just as important as your significant other's job. And it's part of what you have to do. Like, people in the business world have to travel all the time for their jobs. Marketing folks, you know, people that are business project managers, even my husband who works in IT, he travels. He's got to integrate new sites into his company's domain and yada, 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 and a bunch of other shit that I don't understand. And we all have to do it. We all have to do it. So don't feel guilty about it. Just do it. Have your support network in place and get your education so you can move up in the hierarchy and not have to do it as much.
Yeah, those are amazing tips.
Yeah.
I don't know what else you can do. Like, you've got to live your life, and your job and cultural resource management is just one aspect of it that poorly funds it.
Well, at least it funds it, though.
Sort of.
All right. Well, Carrie, thank you so much for coming on the show. I appreciate it. I know it's Sunday morning, so you have stuff to do, but thanks for taking the time to talk to all of us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
That's it for another episode of the CRM Archaeology Podcast. Links to some of the items mentioned on the show are in the show notes for this podcast, which can be found at www.arcpodnet.com/CRM Arc Podcast. Please comment and share anywhere you see the show. If you'd like us to answer a question on a future episode, email us. Use the contact form on the website or just email chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Support the show and the network at arcpodnet.com/members. Get some swag and extra content while you're there. Send us show suggestions and interview suggestions. We want this to be a resource for field technicians everywhere, and we want to know what you want to know about. Thanks to everyone for joining me this week. Thanks also to the listeners for tuning in, and we will see you in the field. Goodbye.
Adios.
Bye.
Nothing. Doug's counting down again in the thing.
Goodbye, everyone. Hey, Chris, I mean, I started at 10. Sometimes I start at like 50 or something. I threw you a bone this time.
Wait, Carrie, you got to say bye.
Oh, do I? I didn't realize that. Yeah. Goodbye, everyone. Thanks for listening to me.
Oh, all right. Finally, someone beat Doug for the first time ever.
This show is produced and recorded by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle, in Reno, Nevada, at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.